Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. The community here has been off retreat for about a month now, and just kind of in my own mind, thinking about what we have to be doing here in the future, sort of what's a lot of events are starting to appearing on the calendar. Things are starting to get more busy. We have Ajahn Dunn will be visiting from Thailand and coming with the three other senior monks as well. Several of them, say the community members here know, so it's going to be, for me, it'll be fun to connecting with some old friends. And then we have three ordinations sort of planned, an Anagaric ordination, Samanera, and a Bhikkhu ordination. So there's been a lot of activity with sewing robes and getting the candidates sort of trained, getting the memorizing the training, memorizing the chanting and the procedures. So there's been some activity there. We've been busy with building committee activities and also some teaching. The Ajahns, senior Ajahns, have been busy with planning future teaching engagements, whole sort of systems of training. Also, Ajahn Yaniko and Tanti Tapo are planning on doing a tudong, a longer tudong. And so I've been, kind of thinking of like all these activities that are coming up. Kind of seeing some threads that connect them all. And then tonight, this evening, or afternoon, at the end of the chanting of the monks' rules, which we do about 4 o'clock in the afternoon out in the forest, though the monastic community gets together, Lumpur gave a little talk at the end of it, and part of it was just talking about faith. And one of the things he said about that was that you're kind of looking at faith as like a courage, kind of having a, one way you can translate the word faith is confidence. And sada is confidence, which I've always liked. This is kind of the first time I've heard that usage, like having a more of like a courage, seeing it as, you put yourself into a training and, really give yourself to that. It was a nice introduction or kind of supplement to what I was already thinking of talking about. Earlier in the week, I have been talking to Ajahn Yaniko and Tanti Tapo about their tudong. It was about a week ago, Tanti Tapo asked me if there was, just if we could get together and talk about it a little bit. It's kind of scary to think about it, but it was already 8 years ago that I had attempted to walk from New Orleans up to Canada. The idea was to follow the Mississippi River for most of the way. The original idea was to do something pretty similar to what Ajahn Yaniko's and Tanti Tapo were going to do, which was, my original idea was maybe to start down at Wat Metta or someplace like Los Angeles or someplace like that, and then walk basically California up to maybe Birkin Monastery. Or that was the original idea. And I started asking around senior monks to see if anybody would be interested in joining me, and nobody was. I didn't get the clue. But I mentioned it to Ajahn Punadamo, actually, and I mentioned it to him only because I had always told him, like, he was one of my first inspirations for ordaining. It was Ajahn Punadamo. And I'd always kind of had in the back of my mind that after I'd completed 5 years as a monk, I would go and live with him up in Thunder Bay, Ontario, which is just north of Minnesota. And so I called him and just was talking to him and told him that I was thinking of he kind of knew I had that as in the back of my mind, and I mentioned to him that I probably was thinking of not coming because, you know, I had this idea of doing a tudong. And he's like, oh, that sounds really interesting. He gave me his blessings, and then he said, that sounds really interesting. I've always wanted to do one. And so I mentioned what I was thinking of doing, and he said, well, have you ever thought about doing Highway 61, which starts in New Orleans? One end of it is in New Orleans, and the other end is Thunder Bay, Ontario. And I started thinking about it, and it's like, and it goes through all these, you know, classic American cities. You know, Highway 61 is the sort of the blues highway, you know, shows up in, I think, a lot of pop culture songs, Bob Dylan songs, and, you know, so it goes Memphis, Tennessee, and St. Louis, and it's pretty close to Chicago, and Minneapolis, Minnesota, and just as soon as I heard that, just something in me just felt like that was the right thing to do, and so I'm kind of from that area as well, and so I kind of, at least from the Midwest part of it, and so we started making plans, and we just recently, when Tontitapo asked me, if, you know, sort of, if he said there was anything that I would do differently, or I forget exactly how the question was asked, but it was something like that, like, if you did it again, was there anything you'd do differently? My first reaction was, I wouldn't do it at all. And it was only meant half as a joke, because it's like, part of me is like, yeah, I don't think I would do it again. But after he asked that question, it's interesting that this last 3 or 4 days, my mind has actually started turning towards the sort of the positive aspects of the walk, and the kind of, I can see some, there's this little bit of kind of thing, that would be fun to do that again. I'm not, in my mind, I see in the back of my mind, I'm really committed to being here for the building committee and really wanting to get the reception hall finished. That's probably 2 years, at least 2 years of being here. But, you know, after that, it was actually the sort of the, like, you know, the poetry of it all. It's like the day that Austin and I stopped walking on the walk that we tried to do, it was the day before my 40th birthday. You know, I was thinking, well, if we did finish the Dhamma Hall and I started again, it would be very shortly after my 50th birthday. So it'd be like, you know, 10 year sort of interruption in the walk. But so it's, you know, just that thought came into my mind. So I'm not planning anything, but maybe I am. But so that came into my mind. The tudong itself was, it was this, I'd say, a really, you know, powerful experience of when I talked about it after it was over, the thing that I saw that I got the most from it was this sort of confidence, or this ability to live with uncertainty, especially during the walk itself. You know, it's like there were just so many unknowns about the walk. I had only been to New Orleans one time in my life, and really didn't know anything about Louisiana or Mississippi. People used to ask me before I did the walk if I was, you know, planning anything or had any, you know, ideas and stuff. And my response was that, you know, Mississippi and Louisiana were just, you know, these, you know, flat pages on a map. You know, one was light green and one was purple. You know, it's like, that's the only sort of image I really had of the whole area. And I remember at one point when I was having real difficulty in the beginning, Ajahn, or Austin and I, the man who walked with me, were having a really hard time finding places to sleep. And I was on the phone with Ajahn Punadamo, and it was really funny, because he's like, have you just thought about sleeping under bridges? And things like that. And it was really kind of a funny comment, because the part of the country we were in was actually under sea level. So it's like, there aren't any bridges. You know, it's like, so if you've never been to some place, you know, like, it's easy to sort of come up with suggestions or ideas or thoughts about things. But when you actually put yourself in the environment, it can be, you know, very different. And so that, you know, we started, you know, finding that, you know, happening. Just it was really good, you know, setting off on the journey with really not having any sort of fixed agenda, not having a plan other than heading north and just really seeing what happens. The concept or the thought that Lumpur was talking about of, confidence and faith, just real fearlessness. The very first week of the Tudong, they said we didn't have any agenda, but we also didn't really have any experience with it as well. I had done a lot of reading about people who had been on walks, either sort of as pilgrimages or Tudongs in our own tradition. Probably the very first person for me who was really an inspiration even in monastic life was a woman named Peace Pilgrim. And I read about her, it was about 20 years ago. It was the first book that I read that really kind of moved my heart in a way towards renunciation. And at the time I was thinking about quitting my job and moving into an ashram, and a friend of mine had visited this particular ashram, so I asked if I could get some information from him, and he gave me some material on the ashram, but he also just threw in this book. It's a biography of Peace Pilgrim, and I remember I just sat down and started reading it. It was like 5 or 6 in the afternoon or something. Started reading it, and I just couldn't set the book down. I read it cover to cover in one sitting, and I was like very emotional in reading it. I was like crying through most of it, and this thought came into my mind. It's like there was something really true in my heart, like about the way she lived her life and what she did, which I'll talk about here in a minute. But there was this feeling that, it's like what she did was, it's like I should be doing that myself, and not necessarily the way Peace Pilgrim did, but there's this feeling of I have lived that way before, and maybe in past lives, but. It's like it's something that needs to be done in this life. And so what happened was with Peace Pilgrim is, like her backstory was that she had been really interested in peace, for almost all of her life. And during the Korean War, she was working as a secretary for somebody who was kind of in that movement. And her story is really incredible. Like she made minimal salary. You can imagine somebody who's working as a secretary for a peace organization, they're not going to have a whole lot of money. But like her expenses were like next to nothing, and like she only used about half of her salary, and so making next to nothing, she gave half of her salary back to her employer because it was a cause that she really believed in. And so she already had lived very simply. But she had this kind of a spiritual awakening. She was hiking the Appalachian Trail, I guess it was, as a through hiker, she was doing the entire 2,000-mile hike on her own, and she had this sort of spiritual awakening or this vision, and it was to walk for world peace, and so she changed her name to Peace Pilgrim. And she started in Pasadena, and she said she started headed off the Rose Bowl parade. She was sort of walking in front of the beginning of the parade, and she had printed up these sort of flyers or pamphlets of what she was doing, and her idea was to walk from Pasadena to New York City to the UN building, and she was going to collect signatures to asking for the United States to withdraw from Korea. And so she walked all the way across the United States. And but the thing was, she did it she had a blue T-shirt that said Peace Pilgrim on the front of it, and on the back of it said, walking 5,000 miles for world peace. And in the front of her shirt, she had this little pocket, and in it it contained all of her worldly possessions, which were was a comb, a ballpoint pen, and I think there was one other thing, but that was it, basically. A toothbrush. Thanks, Dennis. And so all the essentials, that was all she needed. And she didn't carry money. She wouldn't accept money either. So this was the first time I'd ever heard of that. It was the first time I'd ever heard this concept of not using money. It was so ingrained in my life. I didn't even know you could live without money. And so this really struck me. And so she just walked across the country, and she never even asked for anything. She never asked for food. She never asked for shelter. But she said in all of her travels, the longest she ever went without eating was 3 days. And it was even less than that for shelter. And so she walked all the way across the United States, and I think really had a great time, and decided to walk back to California. Like that, the walk wasn't finished, and so she walked back, and then she ended up doing this for 28 years, and instead of going back to the worldly life, she kept the name Peace Pilgrim and did this, and so that made a real big impression on me. So then when I ordained in this tradition, it was quite interesting. I didn't realize that the Thai forest tradition, or even say Buddhist monastic traditions, had a wandering tradition. My experience had always been through retreat centers and seeing teachers at monasteries, or I've never met anybody wandering in any religious tradition. So when I ordained, and it was about halfway through my novice year, and I started hearing stories about Tudong, and it was like, oh, wow, that's actually a possibility. The way it usually works is that it's not until after you've been fully ordained for 5 years that the senior monk would give somebody permission to go on a we call it Tudong. And so at that point, I was, I still had 5 years away, so I kind of put the whole kind of idea out of my mind. Didn't give it any thought, because there wasn't. Ajahn Siddhanta was the only one he and Ajahn Acilo had done a walk to the coast, and that was the only wandering that sort of happened. Some people in our community in England, some of the nuns even have done some walks there, and I heard about those, but it was pretty far off possibility, so I didn't think about it at all. But then as my fifth Vasa approached, second Gulf War broke out. And so I had this idea that I wanted to make a statement. I wanted to, say, go out on a peace walk, sort of do something like that. Fortunately, very quickly after sort of thinking about this, it just didn't seem right to be doing something political. And so I kind of dropped that agenda. Lumpur had advised me, if I was going to do a walk, not to ask anybody to go with me, just to see what happens. And I was actually prepared to go down and do it just completely on my own. And then our neighbor, who's since passed away, Jay, offered to go with me. Jay and I got along quite well, but I had a suspicion that our personalities would clash. And so he and I just kind of detested. We did a walk down to San Francisco, so we did like a week walk down there. Sure enough, at the end of the walk, we had a really good time. Some learned quite a bit about. It shattered my complete expectations of what it would be like to do a walk. I learned some things that I wouldn't do. Basically, we had planned too much. Like, we kind of knew where we were going to go most nights, and had invitations to stay places, and that kind of got in the way. But it was a good experience. But at the end of it, Jay looked at me and he goes, "I think you're right." He says, "I think we would probably kill each other if we tried to do this." And then very shortly after that, this man who was visiting here every year, he'd come every year for a month or so, He just heard about the walk, and he said, he told me later, he said, my first thought was when I heard about you doing this walk was, it just filled, he sort of imagined himself doing it, and he said it just filled him with fear, and he decided that he wanted to confront that fear, and he was in a position in his life where he didn't have too many commitments, and so he asked if he could join me on the walk. And then sure enough, after the first week of the walk, we were talking about sort of what was happening and some of the fears we were having at the time. And he said, now I understand why Lumpur told you, you know, not to ask anybody to come. He said, because if you had asked me to come on this walk, he said, I would hate you right now. So it was, Lumpur was very wise on many accounts here. And so that first week was the uncertainty was just around, basically the hardest part was finding places to sleep. I was kind of worried about eating and if we were going to get fed and how that was going to work. But every day we needed to go on alms round. Food was given to us. Austin, being a layperson, he was able to carry money. And just like almost every, I don't say every day, but people were wanting to support us that way. And so Austin was able to carry money and then buy food with it and carry food. So it wasn't kind of your traditional sort of Tudong going completely on faith that way. But we started with no money and you know, the support came. So the biggest uncertainty came around places to stay. And again, Lumpur had advised us to not to ask anybody directly, like that sort of to, you know, kind of imposing, like it might be hard for someone to say no if they really didn't want to or that. And I think it was the one thing we were almost ready to sort of go against Lumpur's wishes, because as we would meet people on the side of the road or meet people, and we'd explain to them what we were doing, and they'd be like, you know, really encouraging, or that sounds really great, and then say, you know, we're looking for a place to stay. You know, do you have any, you know, just pitching a tent? Do you have our tarp? We didn't have tents, we had tarps. And we're like, you know, do you have any suggestion of where we could stay? Like looking in their front yard, which is full of trees and stuff like this, you know. And they're like, no, can't think of any place. And then a couple places, it was like abandoned kind of like yards next door and stuff like that. And I would just sort of like make a hint, like, well, how about the place next door? And they go, well, we don't own that, you know, can't give you permission there. And so we ended up having to sleep in the floodplain of the Mississippi River, which I don't recommend. it was a sewer, basically. Like everything that could, 27 states or something like that. All the sewers from, you know, every single county, you know, flows into the water systems, and it all ends up in the Mississippi River. And so everything that can float sort of goes into the Mississippi River, and then at flood water, it's all in there. And then when it recedes, it all is on the shore. Like one afternoon, I decided to clear a walking path just to do a walking path, and it was not even from, you know, one wall to the other here, about 25 feet, and you know, I have it in my journal, like, you know, like how many motor oil bottles I moved, how many soda bottles I moved, how many, you know, styrofoam cups I moved. It was like 30 of each, you know, just to create this little tiny path, and it was so bizarre, because it was like if you looked down, just on the ground, it did look like you were in a dump. But if you just kept your vision, you know, above the ground, it was just like you were in this, like, you know, pristine Louisiana swamp, which is, I mean, beautiful. You know, sort of the moss hanging from the trees and egrets flying around and all the birds, and, you know, so it was quite beautiful and quite ugly at the same time. But so the fear, you know, was the uncertainty was, you know, where we're gonna stay. Also, several, you know, unpleasant encounters with people who were not not supportive of more monastic, or say more Buddhism than say what we were doing with the walk and things like that. And nothing negative, nothing, you know, nothing overly hostile, but just sort of getting some negative people just being aggressive, you know, in a way of like letting you know they didn't think you were on the right path, kind of in a way of thinking about it. And so we were kind of shaken by that and a little bit fearful. And at a certain point, I think where it happened for me was we had had a really long day where we had walked, I think it was 20, 25 miles, and just looking for a place to pitch our tarps. And we got to this little town, and as was the norm down there, was there were no payphones. All the payphones had been removed because people have cell phones now. And we got to this little convenience store, and we walked around it to see if there was a payphone. And it was interesting, like something really beautiful happened too. So Austin went in to go into the store to find out where there was a payphone. And while he was in there, this man, you know, heard his conversation, asking where there was a payphone, and saw, you know, what saw we had backpacks and could tell that we were probably really tired. And this man who he looked, you know, like a construction worker, really, really rough. And he just came running out and handed Austin his cell phone and said, "Here, you know, make a phone call." And unfortunately, we made the call and the person we were trying to reach wasn't there. But it was like, you know, this real sense of generosity, and, you know, we people did want to help. And we ended up having to walk another 3 miles to get to the payphone. But as we were there, when Austin was inside, I decided to walk around the building one more time just to make sure we didn't miss the phone. And as I was coming around the corner, I saw this, what I thought was a Coca-Cola vending machine. And I stopped at it and I looked at it, and I realized it was a live bait machine. Yeah. You know, since in Louisiana, it's always fishing and stuff like that. And so it was, you know, you could put in a dollar and you get a box of crickets, or, you know, live crickets. And I remember just having this real strong, you know, revulsion just sort of going through my body. And I was like, I'm not ready for Louisiana. And sure enough, we did finally reach Austin reached one of his friends who he had known from college. And that was even sweet too, because it was about 9 o'clock at night, and we were pretty close to this, I think it was Highway 10, Interstate 10, and we were at this gas station, and there was this really nice grassy area between the gas station and the off-road, and we were both exhausted. We were just kind of leaning up against this telephone pole or something, waiting for his friend, and these two young girls came up to get gas, and they saw us there, and then as they were leaving, they pulled up, and she said, "I'm sorry to bother you," she said, "but I normally wouldn't offer anybody a ride, but you two look so peaceful. You know, do you need a ride someplace?" And we're like, "We're not peaceful. We're just tired." But we didn't need the ride, and so, it was interesting. Like, you know, how difficult it was. There were people, you know, all throughout the day were stopping and, you know, and offering us help and things like that. So that was like the roughest day, and it was still many times there were people offering us help. And it was very inspiring. Then we got to our friend's house in Baton Rouge, and I called Lumpur, and we both just wanted to quit. We were just like so, I wouldn't say fed up, but we were just like, I think both of us were hoping the other one would quit. Neither one, we were both too proud to do it, and so, and we called Lumpur on the phone and. Or emailed, I forget how it was, and he just sort of said, "Have patience. Just have some patience with it. You know, it's like it'll." He didn't say it would work out. He just said, "Have patience." And so we started looking at the map, and we realized there was a national park. It's actually a national park that stretches all the way across the state of Mississippi, and it follows this ancient trade route, probably thousands of years old, and. It's called the Natchez Trace Parkway. And so we arranged to have ourselves dropped off in the southwest corner of Mississippi. And it was interesting because that morning that we went up there, we didn't know actually kind of what day of the week it was or anything, but it turned out to be a Sunday morning. And we were going by all these sort of Baptist churches and forget the other denomination where they speak in tongues, Pentecostal churches and things like that, and people were coming out of the churches, and I was thinking, what in the world am I doing down here in rural South where I don't know anybody? You know, someone's going to drop me off and drive a couple hundred miles away, and I'll be here with just Austin. And so we got dropped off at this tent, campground, and there was some big thunderstorms. This is like very first of March, so the thunderstorms were going to roll in. So Austin and I just decided we would just stay there for 2 days and just meditate and kind of get our bearings before we started walking. And then on the second day, I remember just like sitting in underneath my tarp, just shaking. I was actually kind of just so scared, nervous about what we were doing. And they kind of show you how nervous I was, because I think Austin was the same. He wrote in his journal that day, he said, if someone tells me they have no fear of death, I'm going to challenge them to walk through Mississippi dressed the way I'm dressed. You know, it was just like, that was, as soon as he read that to me, it kind of lightened my heart a little bit. It was like, okay, that's, at least we're on the same page. And there was a lull in the storm, so I went for this walk, and I was walking, and I was just, you know, sort of contemplating this fear. And all of a sudden it just dawned on me that I'd been doing some reading of other people on Tudong, and particularly Ajahn Mun. And all of a sudden it just hit me like a ton of bricks. It was just like, this is why Ajahn Mun lived the way he did. This is why he encouraged his monks to go out into the jungles, you know, to live in areas where there's, you know, not just tigers and elephants, but malaria, and just not knowing, you know, when you leave the monastery, you know, are you going to eat that day or that week? You know, where are you going to get water? Where are you going to bathe? You know, all these sort of things that we take for granted here. You know, are you going to be dry? You know, you might be wet for 3 or 4 days before you can even get dry. You know, everything, all these conveniences that we have that we just take for granted. You know, just this, you know, contemplating, just even thinking about it for yourself, just like, okay, I'm going to just walk over to Fort Bragg. You know, just even that, just the inconvenience of that can be quite scary, and all the uncertainty. So I realized, well, I'm doing exactly what, you know, Ajahn Mun encouraged, except for, I think, you know, our fear was more around humans, which I think are more dangerous than tigers, but as soon as I had this realization, I remembered finally that another piece of advice Lumpur gave me was that I should be using loving kindness as my main meditation object, and I don't think I'd done it at all at that point. And so I got really excited about this, and I ran back and explained the sort of insight I'd had to Austin, and I could see it kind of changed his mood, and so I taught him, you know, what I knew of loving kindness meditation at that point, and we spent the afternoon sort of chanting and doing that meditation. And then the very next morning, we decided we were running out of food, so we decided we needed to start moving again. And typically, as a monk, we're not, you know, encouraged to be too outwardly engage with our, say, expressions or making face contact with people and things like that. And it's pretty much for the first week of the walk, I had just been walking, sort of looking down at the pavement and not making too much eye contact with people. But as we started walking, I just decided I would, every approaching car that came up, I would just sort of just wave and smile. And I started noticing, I guess I'd noticed some people's expressions before that, and they'd always been kind of like, what in the world is that? You know, seeing, there's, you know, a Buddhist monk on the side of the road, you know, kind of looks of bewilderment or judgment or, you know, sort of negativity almost. But as I started, you know, smiling, sort of waving, there'd be that initial sort of, what is that? But then they'd see I was smiling, and then they'd smile and wave back. Because like 95% of the people kind of gave me this sort of, you know, smile or thumbs up or something like that. So immediately just sort of doing this, you know, sort of loving kindness practice, and then just doing something, you know, something subtle, like just smiling to people, you know, I was getting these positive reactions. And I started doing it also too, basically because of safety. I really wanted to just make eye contact with the driver to see, make sure they knew that we were there on the side, walking on the side of the road. And I told Titapo, walking on the side of the road, we were always, walking towards the traffic. So it's close to you, but for safety reasons. But still, I almost got killed one day where a semi truck was passing, was in the passing lane. And Austin said it just missed me by like about an inch. I didn't hear it until it was like right on me, part of it was just for safety reasons, making eye contact with the driver. But I noticed it in my own heart, it was like it just made things lighter to sort of making contact, eye contact, and smiling. And then we came to this a historical marker site, and there was some rangers that were there, and so we just sort of stopped to see what the site was, and it turns out that there were, we asked the ranger there about, we kind of told him our plans and things like that, and you're only supposed to camp with in designated areas, which are about 30 miles apart for sort of bike tourists. That's like, most people don't walk it, it's done by car or bike. And it was really interesting. It's like we've been practicing at that point, a full day with loving kindness, been doing it all morning, and you could just see it in the ranger's face. He was like, okay, we asked him what the sort of situation was, and he said, you have to stay in these campsites, they're 30 miles apart, and so like that. And he knew our destination, and he said, well, how far are you walking today? And I said, about 10 miles. And you could see his calculations, like, you're not gonna make it. And he immediately changed the conversation. I know what you're doing, and we're not gonna just, it's like, it was almost like, he can't say yes, you can do that, but he's like, and I asked Austin about it later, and he said, yeah, I had the same impression. And that happened later in the walk, about a week later, where a ranger just sort of pulled over and sort of just asked us how far we're walking today. And you could just see in her head, she was sort of calculating, and she like completely changed the subject. So it was like people were really trying to help us out in that way. But while we were there, these three old guys came over and started talking to us. And I guess we had also asked the ranger about where grocery stores or where the nearest town was. We knew the nearest town was about 25 miles away. But there were some smaller towns along the way. This ranger was like, no, there's absolutely nothing in those towns. It's like one or two houses. They're kind of abandoned towns. There's not even a convenience store. There's no way you'll be able to buy food in those towns or get food or go on alms round. Yes, you could go on alms round, but there wasn't any place you could buy food. And then we're like, okay, well, we're not going to eat today. We're definitely not going to get 25 miles in before noon, but tomorrow we will be able to eat. And we were quite content with that. And then just as we were ready to leave, these three old guys came up to us and asked what we were doing. And it turns out that they were had a priest who had just moved into the area from India, and were just taking him around to all the local sites. And they asked us if we wanted a ride. And we hadn't actually... Well, we'd just taken a ride all the way across Louisiana, so we decided, why not? And they dropped us off. And it was like the first time people had really been generous. And then when we got to Port Gibson, was the name of the town, they asked us if we would do a blessing chant for them. And then they gave us a bunch of food and dropped us off. And so that was the first day of really doing the loving kindness practice. And it was almost like every single day after that, stuff like that happened, after sort of using this loving kindness as a practice. I could go on all night talking about this, but from these stories, when I was talking about it afterwards, I don't think I really kind of got it at the time, but say near the very end of the walk, we had connected with the Catholic Church, and my friend Father William Skudlarek, he had been reading our, we were keeping an online journal, and people were kind of checking it out. And he was in Bogota, Colombia, and suggested that I get in touch with the Catholic Church in Jackson, Mississippi, and we did. And they set us up in three different churches along the way, you know, communities, and ended up staying with them. And the very, I guess it was one of the last places we were staying, there were three nuns that were living in this like parish house in it was Houston, Mississippi. And I had this this great experience where it was, I think it was, yeah, it was Easter, Easter weekend. And one of their supporters came over, and she had just made this this rhubarb pie. You know, it was this fresh pie. And I was standing behind the donor, sort of facing the sisters as they came in and gave this beautiful offering. And as I was, you know, watching this, the sisters, when they received this pie, their faces just lit up. I mean, it's like, you know, they really, to me at that time, just looked like angels. They were just like, you know, so appreciative of getting this gift. And it was quite powerful for me, because I'd been on the receiving end of so much generosity and being supported supported emotionally as well as say physically, you know, by that, as being people helping you along the way. And then so to actually see somebody else's reaction to, you know, receiving something like that, it was just like, you know, kind of what came into my mind was like, you know, I hope that I'm worthy of, like, you know, when I receive something like that, I hope, you know, like that person sees that same reaction in me. You know, like, I hope I'm worthy of that gift. And so it really created this, the whole, you know, I could see the whole walk as being this real, you know, humility and a sense of, you know, wanting to practice really well when you receive that kind of support and generosity. And also from that, I remember talking to, I guess I wrote it in my journal, but Father William pointed out that it was like one of the most things that he appreciated the most about our journal was that it was at that same time, it was probably maybe even because of that sort of interaction, that I had said that, you know, when I started the Tudong, part of it was is like I had done a lot of reading of people doing these pilgrimages, these walks, say Peace Pilgrim. There was also this man, Satish Kumar, who walked all the way across from India to Europe, and then he traveled a little bit in the United States completely without money. And you know, he had, you know, really great experiences, kind of, with that as well. Say not using money, and so I read so many of these sort of accounts. There's probably like three or four at least of people doing something very similar to this. And after reading so many of these accounts, it's like there was part of my heart that said, you know, I know this. I have a confidence. There was this real trust that if you put yourself out there in the world without any money, without any real sense of support, that you would be taken care of. You know, I have no idea why, but I just, you know, I read so many accounts of it happening. And it's very similar to what all of us here are doing, the monastics. You know, it's like we really, none of us have any money. We don't have any, you know, security in a bank account or anything like that. We really do live completely on trust. But it can... It doesn't seem that way, because it's like the whole time I've been here, there's always been breakfast and there's always been the meal. But that's not necessarily the case, and that's always going to be that way. And so when you go out on these tudongs, you really, you know, you're really putting on, you know, on the line, you know, what it is that you, why you said you ordained. You're just living on that kind of confidence, that faith. And so what I wrote was that that, you know, I kind of went on the Tudong to just to see, just to kind of prove to myself that this would work, you know, that I really wanted to, I had a confidence that it would work, but I really wanted to to experience it. You know, I wanted to really get a firsthand experience of it. And I had this sort of thought that it was like, you know, it kind of comes from my days of playing American football. You know, it's just sort of like, you know, you only get strong by, you know, sort of pushing yourself or... it's like you'll know that you're sort of, you know, say tough because, you know, you can endure something, you can push through the hardships. You know, sort of like, yeah, I'll know I'm strong because I'm strong enough to get through this. You know, I can overcome these hardships, I can overcome these fears. But what happened was is that I realized that every single time I had a really heavy burden, it was lifted from me by somebody else. Every single time. It was like, you know, somebody, you know, when we didn't, you know, we thought we were going to have to walk 25 miles for the meal. It was like, you know, I was like, okay, yeah, we can do that. But then somebody came along and offered us a ride. Or when we'd walk 20 miles and, you know, needed to make a phone call, someone came out with their cell phone and offered it to us. Or when we decided that Louisiana is not the place to be walking, you know, somebody offered us a ride to Mississippi. You know, sort of the entire walk just became that way. You know, it was like when we needed to get on a train to go to Chicago, it was like that became available. And we needed a place to stay after we realized we both got very ill on this walk. That's why we didn't finish it. And, you know, when we needed places to stay, those places became available. And it's like, yeah, every single time on this walk, whenever we were really in need, even when we weren't really in need, but just so it's like our you know, the going on these tudongs, it was really powerful for me. And just the fact that it was like, you know, what we are learning here in the monastery, you know, what we're doing, you know, how we're training, it was just really, you know, going out on the road was just an extension of that. It's like sort of the security and the safety of what we have here. It's like we're actually not doing too much different, you know, here in the monastery. But, you know, going out there, it's just, you know, that safety net is gone. And it just brings to me just more to life, you know, living here in the monastery. It's just so much easier to connect with that, yeah, this meal isn't a guarantee, or, you know, the support isn't always a guarantee. And it just helps to really appreciate and feel a lot more humble with the offerings that we do get. So I was thinking of, you know, how to tie this in with, say, Ajahn Dunn's visit and the ordinations and, you know, all the activities, you know, we have coming up. And I've kind of gone off on a little bit of a sidetrack, you know, talking more about the tudongs, but, you know, especially, yeah, with the ordinations coming up. And, you know, I think it's a good, you know, some of these reflections from the tudong, and definitely Ajahn Nyaniko and, you know, Titapo. I'm really excited for those who are getting ready to ordain and to, you know, sort of be entering into this, yeah, just a real life of renunciation, you know, that sort of sense of yeah, putting yourself out there, you know, into the training and seeing, you know, having faith and confidence and seeing what happens. And I'm really excited for Titapo and Ajahn Nyaniko going out on their tudong. I think their experiences are going to be probably completely different than the one Austin and I had. I've told them, it's like, you know, my fear was, or, you know, the difficulty was finding places to sleep. I have suspicion like theirs is going to be just the opposite. You know, they'll probably have no problems doing that, but, you know, maybe food will be a problem, or maybe it won't. So, you know, however their tudong works out, I'm really excited for them and wish them the best. So I'll leave that for our contemplation.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.